I'm Jed Cole. Today's special episode is in two parts. In the second, I'm joined by my friend, literary scholar and co-host of the Horror Vanguard podcast, John the Litcrit Guy. But first, a story to begin exploring the question I'm pondering right now. What does Halloween signify in this time? A time of pandemic, of nihilism, of violent state repression, of darkness and anxiety, of ghosts, of things we'd rather not think about. Today, Inside the Text presents The Mask of the Red Death by Edgar Allan Poe. The Red Death had long devastated the country. No pestilence had ever been so fatal or so hideous. Blood was its avatar and its seal, the redness and the horror of blood. There were sharp pains and sudden dizziness, and then profuse bleeding at the pores with dissolution. The scarlet stains upon the body and especially upon the face of the victim were the pest ban, which shut him out from the aid and from the sympathy of his fellow men. And the whole seizure, progress, and termination of the disease were the incidents of half an hour. But the Prince Prospero was happy and dauntless and sagacious. When his dominions were half depopulated, he summoned to his presence a thousand hale and light-hearted friends from among the knights and dames of his court, and with these retired to the deep seclusion of one of his castellated abbeys. This was an extensive and magnificent structure, the creation of the prince's own eccentric yet august taste. A strong and lofty wall girdled it in. This wall had gates of iron. The courtiers, having entered, brought furnaces and massy hammers and welded the bolts. They resolved to leave means neither of ingress nor egress to the sudden impulses of despair or frenzy from within. The abbey was amply provisioned. With such precautions, the courtiers might bid defiance to contagion. The external world could take care of itself. In the meantime, it was folly to grieve or to think. The prince had provided all the appliances of pleasure. There were buffoons, there were improvisatori, there were ballet dancers, there were musicians, there was beauty, there was wine. All these and security were within. Without was the Red Death. It was towards the close of the fifth or sixth month of his seclusion, and while the pestilence raged most furiously abroad, that the Prince Prospero entertained his thousand friends at a masked ball of the most unusual magnificence. It was a voluptuous scene, that masquerade, but first let me tell of the rooms in which it was held. These were seven, an imperial suite. In many palaces, however, such suites form a long and straight vista while the folding doors slide back nearly to the walls on either hand, so that the view of the whole extent is scarcely impeded. Here, the case was very different, as might have been expected from the Duke's love of the bizarre. The apartments were so irregularly disposed that the vision embraced but little more than one at a time. There was a sharp turn at every 20 or 30 yards, and at each turn a novel effect. To the right and left, in the middle of each wall, a tall and narrow Gothic window looked out upon a closed corridor which pursued the windings of the suite. These windows were of stained glass, whose color varied in accordance with the prevailing hue of the decorations of the chamber into which it opened. That at the eastern extremity was hung, for example, in blue, and vividly blue were its windows. The second chamber was purple in its ornaments and tapestries, and here the panes were purple. The third was green throughout, and so were the casements. The fourth was furnished and lighted with orange, the fifth with white, the sixth with violet. The seventh apartment was closely shrouded in black velvet tapestries that hung all over the ceiling and down the walls, falling in heavy folds upon a carpet of the same material and hue. But in this chamber only, the color of the windows failed to correspond with the decorations. The panes here were scarlet, a deep blood color. Now, in no one of the seven apartments was there any lamp or candelabrum amid the profusion of golden ornaments that lay scattered to and fro or depended from the roof. There was no light of any kind emanating from lamp or candle within the suite of chambers. But in the corridors that followed the suite, there stood opposite to each window a heavy tripod bearing a brazier of fire that projected its rays through the tinted glass and so glaringly illumined the room, and thus reproduced a multitude of gaudy and fantastic appearances. But in the western or black chamber, the effect of the firelight that streamed upon the dark hangings through the blood-tinted panes was ghastly in the extreme, and produced so wild a look upon the countenances of those who entered that there were few of the company bold enough to set foot within its precincts at all. It was in this apartment also that there stood against the western wall a gigantic clock of ebony. Its pendulum swung to and fro with a dull, heavy, monotonous clang. And when the minute hand made the circuit of the face, and the hour was to be stricken, there came from the brazen lungs of the clock a sound which was clear and loud and deep and exceedingly musical, but of so peculiar a note and emphasis that at each lapse of an hour, the musicians of the orchestra were constrained to pause momentarily in their performance to hearken to the sound. And thus the waltzers perforce ceased their evolutions, and there was a brief disconcert of the whole gay company. And while the chimes of the clock yet rang, it was observed that the giddiest grew pale, and the more aged and sedate passed their hands over their brows as if in confused reverie or meditation. But when the echoes had fully ceased, a light laughter at once pervaded the assembly. The musicians looked at each other and smiled as if at their own nervousness and folly, and made whispering vows each to the other that the next chiming of the clock should produce in them no similar emotion. And then, after the lapse of 60 minutes, which embrace 3,600 seconds of the time that flies, there came yet another chiming of the clock, and then with the same disconcert and tremulousness and meditation as before. But in spite of these things, it was a gay and magnificent revel. The tastes of the Duke were peculiar. He had a fine eye for colors and effects. He disregarded the decora of mere fashion. His plans were bold and fiery, and his conceptions glowed with barbaric luster. There are some who would have thought him mad. His followers felt that he was not. It was necessary to hear and see and touch him to be sure that he was not. He had directed in great part the movable embellishments of the seven chambers upon occasion of this great fete, and it was his own guiding taste which had given character to the masqueraders. Be sure they were grotesque. There were much glare and glitter and piquancy and phantasm, much of what's been since seen in Hernani. There were arabesque figures with unsuited limbs and appointments. There were delirious fancies such as the madman fashions. There were much of the beautiful, much of the wanton, much of the bizarre, something of the terrible, and not a little of that which might have excited disgust. To and fro in the seven chambers there stalked, in fact, a multitude of dreams, and these, the dreams, writhed in and about, taking hue from the rooms, and causing the wild music of the orchestra to seem as the echo of their steps. And anon there strikes the ebony clock, which stands in the hall of the velvet, and then for a moment all is still, and all is silent, save the voice of the clock. The dreams are stiff frozen as they stand. But the echoes of the chime die away. They have endured but an instant, and a light, half-subdued laughter floats after them as they depart. And now again the music swells, and the dreams live, and writhe to and fro more merrily than ever, taking hue from the many-tinted windows through which stream the rays from the tripods. But to the chamber which lies most westwardly of the seven, there are now none of the maskers who venture. For the night is waning away, and there flows a ruddier light through the blood-colored panes, and the blackness of the sable drapery appalls. And to him whose foot falls upon the sable carpet, there comes from the near clock of ebony a muffled peal more solemnly emphatic than any which reaches their ears who indulged in the more remote gaieties of the other apartments. But these other apartments were densely crowded, and in them beat feverishly the heart of life. And the revel went whirlingly on until at length there commenced the sounding of midnight upon the clock. And then the music ceased, as I've told, and the evolutions of the waltzers were quieted, and there was an uneasy cessation of all things as before. But now there were 12 strokes to be sounded by the bell of the clock. And thus it happened, perhaps, that more of thought crept, with more of time, into the meditations of the thoughtful among those who reveled. And thus, too, it happened, perhaps, that before the last echoes of the last chime had utterly sunk into silence, there were many individuals in the crowd who'd found leisure to become aware of the presence of a masked figure which had arrested the attention of no single individual before. And the rumor of this new presence having spread itself whisperingly around, there arose at length from the whole company a buzz or a murmur, expressive of disapprobation and surprise, then finally of terror, of horror, and of disgust. In an assembly of phantasms such as I painted, it may well be supposed that no ordinary appearance could have excited such sensation. In truth, the masquerade license of the night was nearly unlimited, but the figure in question had out-heroded Herod, and gone beyond the bounds of even the prince's indefinite decorum. There are chords in the hearts of the most reckless which cannot be touched without emotion, even with the utterly lost, to whom life and death are equally jests. There are matters of which no jest can be made. The whole company indeed seemed now deeply to feel that in the costume and bearing of the stranger neither wit nor propriety existed. The figure was tall and gaunt, and shrouded from head to foot in the habiliments of the grave. The mask which concealed the visage was made so nearly to resemble the countenance of a stiffened corpse that the closest scrutiny must have had difficulty in detecting the cheat. And yet all this might have been endured if not approved by the mad revelers around, but the mummer had gone so far as to assume the type of the Red Death. His vesture was dabbled in blood, and his broad brow, with all the features of the face, was besprinkled with the scarlet horror. When the eyes of the Prince Prospero fell upon this spectral image, which, with a slow and solemn movement, as if more fully to sustain its role, stalked to and fro among the waltzers, he was seen to be convulsed, in the first moment, with a strong shudder, either of terror or distaste, but in the next, his brow reddened with rage. "Who dares?" he demanded hoarsely of the courtiers who stood near him. "Who dares insult us with this blasphemous mockery? Seize him and unmask him, that we may know whom we have to hang at sunrise from the battlements." It was in the eastern or blue chamber in which stood the Prince Prospero as he uttered these words. They rang throughout the seven rooms, loudly and clearly, for the prince was a bold and robust man, and the music had become hushed at the waving of his hand. It was in the blue room where stood the prince, with a group of pale courtiers by his side. At first, as he spoke, there was a slight rushing movement of this group in the direction of the intruder, who at the moment was also near at hand, and now, with deliberate and stately step, made closer approach to the speaker. But from a certain nameless awe with which the mad assumptions of the mummer had inspired the whole party, there were found none who put forth hand to seize him, so that, unimpeded, he passed within a yard of the prince's person. And while the vast assembly, as if with one impulse, shrank from the centers of the rooms to the walls, he made his way uninterruptedly, but with the same solemn and measured step which had distinguished him from the first, through the blue chamber to the purple, through the purple to the green, through the green to the orange, through this again to the white, and even thence to the violet, ere a decided movement had been made to arrest him. It was then, however, that the Prince Prospero, maddening with rage and the shame of his own momentary cowardice, rushed hurriedly through the six chambers, while none followed him on account of a deadly terror that had seized upon all. He bore aloft a drawn dagger, and had approached in rapid impetuosity to within 3 or 4 feet of the retreating figure, when the latter, having attained the extremity of the velvet apartment, turned suddenly and confronted his pursuer. There was a sharp cry, and the dagger dropped gleaming upon the sable carpet, upon which, instantly afterwards, fell prostrate in death the Prince Prospero. Then, summoning the wild courage of despair, a throng of the revelers at once threw themselves into the black apartment, and seizing the mummer, whose tall figure stood erect and motionless within the shadow of the ebony black, gasped in unutterable horror at finding the grave cerements and corpse-like mask, which they handled with so violent a rudeness, untenanted by any tangible form. And now was acknowledged the presence of the Red Death. He had come like a thief in the night, and one by one dropped the revelers in the blood-bedewed halls of their revel, and died each in the despairing posture of his fall. And the life of the ebony clock went out with that of the last of the gay, and the flames of the tripods expired, and darkness and decay and the Red Death held illimitable dominion over all. So, John, thank you so freaking much for coming onto this show to talk with me about this very short, very unsubtle little story and the light it might shed, as if by firelight through a bloodstained glass window, onto our present, our tacky black velvet present.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me on. I'm really excited. This is going to be a fun discussion, just about a historical short story that has no resonance for anything that we might currently be living through.
No, nothing titled "Mask of the Red Death" has anything to do with what we're going through right now with the coronavirus pandemic and everything that comes with it. So where to begin? The first thing that comes to my mind is like the idea of escape from thought or escape from grief. Like there's this line where they say, with such precautions, the courtiers might bid defiance to contagion by holding up in this abbey. The external world could take care of itself. In the meantime, it was folly to grieve or to think. How does that strike you?
I mean, isn't this the kind of logical endpoint of a certain meritocratic understanding of society? You know, the rich generally, historically, have never thought that they were rich thanks to astounding good luck or the venal corruption of political systems, right? The rich have always thought that they were rich because they deserved it. And so I think the sentence that's really telling in that quote that you read is, The outside world could take care of itself. The external world could take care of itself. Yeah. Because for them, the external world is always a given, right? If you're rich enough, the external world is just a kind of revealed fact. It has no contingency to it. Because material circumstances help you construct a world which is entirely pleasant to exist in and to move through and to seamlessly, frictionlessly slide from one cloistered and protected state to another. So I think it's really interesting that they decide to shut themselves away, because the world will always be there. And so, really, this whole gigantic soiree, this extravagant display of wealth, is actually just a continuation, right? The party in and of itself is not anything outside of the ordinary for all of these attendees. What's out of the ordinary is this, the plague, the sickness that's going through the land. So I really like this. It kind of paints our victim, protagonists in very interesting light.
Yeah, it's very true. And to be able to just retreat into an abbey that we built, you know, a while back, and just lock the doors and just party. But there keeps being like these reminders as the story goes on, like little intrusions of reality. At least the reality of something, kind of breaking through the cracks in the walls, as it were. The first thing is this: the tolling of this ebony clock that is on one side of the masquerade construction, this bespoke building for the party. And it's there's this part where it says that when midnight strikes, because the tolling takes longer, it happened perhaps that more of thought crept with more of time into the meditations of the thoughtful. And every time the clock tolls on the hour, it's like the whole party kind of pauses, the music stops, and everyone kind of looks around awkwardly, and then afterward kind of laughs and kind of picks up again. How would you like relate that to kind of this idea of the external world?
Well, we did an episode on Horror Vanguard, shameless plug, on a brilliant horror film called A Dark Song, and we were talking about it with Nicole Cliff, who is kind of refreshingly honest about the fact that she is pretty well off. She's rich, and she made, in when we were talking about that film in the episode, she made a really good point, which she said, if you're rich enough, there isn't really any kind of serious problem you might run into apart from death. Like, you know, for most people, you know, your car is totaled and like you can't get to work. That's a serious problem. Yeah. If you're rich enough, you just buy a new car. You know, there isn't a problem here. But the serious problem, the problem that you can't overcome, is death, right? And what is time in this context, if not a reminder, a kind of hourly, literal silencing chime of finitude, right? Time runs out. I mean, really, that's the whole point of the story, right? Mm-hmm. What is time if not a reminder every hour that you are 1 hour closer to exhausting the finite resources of life that we all have? So for most of us, that's a kind of big existential problem. But I suppose in some senses, if you're rich, that's the problem, the only problem. Because it's a problem that you can't buy your way out of. It's not a coincidence, right, that contemporary billionaire libertarian weirdos, their big thing is like, how do we become immortal? Because death is really the death is the last remaining limit, right? It's the last remaining barrier for the sufficiently wealthy. If you're rich enough, there generally doesn't tend to be any other serious problem, and all of these people are clearly fabulously wealthy. But what is a problem is time is finite. Human beings are, we are racked with finitude, and all of us have to come to terms with that. So that's how I read the responses to the clock, because the clock is an indication that time is almost literally running out.
Yeah, and it's interesting too that like it's a reminder of that in the face of them exercising their power to completely escape from the present plague that's killing off everyone else. But yeah, they still they still can't escape that ultimate fate. And speaking of existential crises, which is probably the transition par excellence for our time. It feels noteworthy that these elites lock themselves into an abbey.
I mean, yeah, this is fascinating, isn't it? Because I mean, even in Poe's time, right? This is historical fiction, right? It's basically a fairy. It's almost a fairy tale.
Right.
And so let's kind of historicize just for a moment. So like, even in Poe's time, there was this kind of historical memory to the idea of a naturalized, kind of ontologically true hierarchy of society. You know, nobility were still the only class of any political power, especially here in England or the United Kingdom. But there was this kind of emergent mercantile, industrialist, capitalist class. Mm-hmm. So in this kind of context, right, it makes sense. It makes sense that they would retreat to an abbey, because an abbey is a reflection of the kind of historically ordered hierarchy of existence, right? So the divine right of kings and nobles and all that. Now, interestingly, the thing that I like to think about is if this was set in the contemporary moment, where would they be? Because they wouldn't be in an abbey. They'd probably be somewhere like either like Trump Tower in New York, or they would be in some kind of 3,000 acre ranch in New Zealand.
Something described as a compound.
Yes.
Yeah. Elon Musk's private compound.
Peter Thiel, they're getting like blood transfusions from young teenagers just to try and stave off death.
Right.
So I think it's really interesting, because like the capitalist, the wealthiest and most kind of like politically powerful have always used religion. Religion is a subversive tool, right? Obviously, it cuts both ways. But there is a kind of naturalizing of order that's expressed in, you know, religious ecumenical buildings. You know, mm-hmm. what are cathedrals on the political and material level, if not examples of divine providence, right? The king could construct a cathedral in order to show that the world was ordered this particular way, and that he was in charge because he was the one most favored by the king, by God. So it makes sense, right, that they would be in an abbey. But I also think that it's worth kind of trying to tease that apart a little bit, because, like I say, religion, especially Christian theology, cuts both ways, right? It has a deeply subversive element to it, and even a revolutionary element to it, which makes the thing that Prospero says really interesting. Because what does he refer to when the mysterious figure arrives? He calls it a blasphemous mockery.
Right.
And I think that's a really interesting phrase. That's a very loaded phrase, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it stuck out to me, too. It's like, it's the only line of dialogue in the whole story. You know, who dares, you know, he says, who dares disturb this blasphemous, who dares this blasphemous mockery? And it's like, both of those words are interesting. It's like, blasphemous, what? And then also mockery of what they're doing, like, as if it were serious, you know?
Well, I mean, again, isn't this the kind of thing that, like, if you're rich enough, if you are inured from any kind of discomfort or limitation, I imagine, doesn't illness feel like a kind of sick joke? You know, you're powerful and rich enough to be able to do anything, and yet what kind of like, this is the punchline of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, right?
Right,
you have like cosmically powerful beings, and what is it that gets them? It's the common cold. So like, isn't there something kind of mocking about this? You know, these people who are powerful enough to hold themselves away for a six month long party, and yet there's a sly joke kind of lurking beneath the surface here. So maybe he's right. Maybe it is a mockery, and maybe it's a mockery that's well deserved.
Yeah. Yeah, it's maybe after all, truer words were never spoken in this whole story. It makes me think of like the function of the prophet in the Bible, like the function of sort of shattering the sort of obscurantist story woven by the powerful to legitimize what they've done and what they're doing. And the prophet is called a blasphemer or a liar or a deceiver, but it's just because they're kind of breaking this virtual reality that the rich have built for themselves.
Yeah, which is exactly why it's a mockery, right? You know, because you are exposed to the capital R real. As someone who is kind of chronically ill, I know what it means to be reminded of bodily fragility and to be often forcibly reminded that you are just a kind of pretty sophisticated bag of meat, meat and goo that is animated. But if you are someone who is kind of cosseted and comfortable and never kind of worried about material circumstances, it must be so irritating. It must be, you know, it must feel like a giant prank at your expense to suddenly be brought traumatically face to face with the reality of physical contingency.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happens in the story. So like one of the things I find interesting is sort of the way that the space is laid out in the story. It spends a long time, I mean, it's such a short story, but it spends a lot of real estate talking about the layout of this basically spooky nightclub that is built to just celebrate their chosenness and their invincibility, I guess. And it's like these seven rooms that are like in a zigzag formation that go from east to west. And the only lighting is from these flaming braziers on the other side of these stained glass windows. But no one goes in the last room, which is decorated in this black velvet carpet and these tapestries hanging from the ceiling and coming down in these big, great big folds. And then the light coming through the window is this blood-colored red light. And no one goes into the room because they just kind of can't handle it. And it's almost like a room, it's almost like reserved for the Red Death, you know, which is marked by this blood, bloody avatar, as it says. And so it's fitting that the figure that arrives, the mummer, makes it all the way to the black velvet room where the clock is before Prospero comes at him with a knife. There's a couple of things that are interesting to me about that kind of climactic scene. One is the figure turns around and confronts him, and he's face to face with this figure of death, as you said. And the knife just falls to the floor, and Prospero doubles over and dies. So there's a sense in which, like, it's a person, like, it's a figure, but, like, the person doesn't... There's a sense in the person doesn't really kill Prospero, because the nature of, like, disease is sort of incorporealness to it. You know, it's in the air, you know, you die apart from any kind of instrument. I'm also kind of thinking about, so like the absence of the population in this story, like the people of the country on which the disease is just taking the highest toll, as mentioned in the beginning, it just to say that when half the population had died, Prospero went to this abbey with all his favorite people. Is there a sense in which this figure of the Red Death is sort of a stand-in for those people, for the people that are kind of forgotten by the story or by Prospero?
I mean, there's a joke by Terry Pratchett in the Discworld novels talking about the character of Death. And he says that Death is not cruel, just terribly good at his job. And Which I really like, and it's a very commonly kind of quoted thing from Pratchett's writing. But like, there is an element of truth to this. Like, death is often arbitrary, and dying is often something that happens in very violent and unjust ways. But in many ways, I think there is a depersonal nature to it, right? He doesn't. It's very striking that he looks at the visitor in the face. They come face to face. And what happens is, he dies. There is a. It's not something personal. It's just a process that operates, right? Something just happens, and the prince, with all of his power and authority and wealth, is just gone. Now, there is definitely a link, kind of classically, with this idea of like the monarch being the embodiment of the state, right, and being the representative of all people. And I think we've seen that in both of our respective countries, right? Both of our, for want of a better word, political authorities have been diagnosed with COVID. And the way that that's still talked about is talked about in terms of, like, what does this mean for the country? What does this mean for all of us? Because in some way, there's still the temptation to see the prime minister or the president is not just the leader of the government, but as the head of the state, and therefore their own body is in some way symbolically resonant of the state itself. So can we see it as a kind of like the return of the repressed, the outcast populace, the nameless thousands outside the gates, rising up in the kind of avatar of death itself to destroy the monarchy? Yeah, I think that's absolutely a reading that you could put forward for this.
I think it's interesting too that I was just contemplating that maybe the real fantasy of this story is that the elites die from the disease in the first place, because because it always seems like, oh, they just, you know, you can't help but feel like yeah, Prospero dead, yes. But it's also like, yeah, but that, you know, it feels fantastical precisely because he and all his people, you know, get the disease in the end.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is the thing, right? What, in many ways, life, especially in a place like America, is simply a matter of economics, right? And I mean that, like, on its most foundational level. If, I mean, the kind of true horror, I think Americans are always, whenever someone tells me about the American healthcare system, I'm just sort of like, how are people who work for health insurance companies able to leave their homes without just being like chased down in the street like the monsters they are? Like, This idea that you might die primarily because you don't have enough money to stay alive. That's what it is. This is the kind of like true horror of the current situation. And I think you're completely right. This makes this story is like a fantasy, because like the thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people who've died from this virus, especially in America, have died because they couldn't afford not to. Right. And that is a moral obscenity on a level that I actually think is like difficult to quantify.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And so it's like, where would this story be happening? Would it not be happening maybe at Walter Reed Medical Center? You know, a 6-month lockdown there, but yes, with all of its lavish, gaudy, kitsch, tastelessness, there's also in this story, in this version of the Mask of the Red Death that we're all living through, inside Prospero's Abbey is some of the best medical care in the history of humanity, which is entirely sufficient to save everybody, and is deliberately kept from the population who are outside the gates through choice.
Right, through design.
And I think if you read the story now, and I think, as I say, I think you're completely correct. I think it's there is a fantasy element to it, right? The rich get sick and they die, and we're like, well, we know that that isn't really what happens,
right?
Because the kind of end point here is that we have so closely associated existence with the service of for-profit capitalism that, you know, I was talking to my co-host Ash about this, and he said, really, you know, you're not living through a pandemic, you're living through a for-profit healthcare system that's functioning entirely as designed. It just happens to be with a novel viral infection at the same time. So I think if anything, we should read this and be like, ah, if only.
Right, it's got you know, a fairy tale ending, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely.
The religious aspect, just to return to that real quick, is interesting in light of that too, because religion and death are very intimately related. Religion is supposed to help explain how death works and put it in some kind of context and order.
No, I was just going to say, like, and this is kind of tied into the design of the place, right? That the black room is a memento mori,
mm-hmm.
right? This is a really common thing in religious architecture, right? The just as we are, so shall you be, you know, often engraved around graves or mausoleum,
right?
Because the whole point is that consoling aspect, right? It's designed to go, you know, religion is not something that concerns merely the kind of practical lived day to day, but also it's a reminder of our own limitation, the reminder that we are all going to die. And I find it really interesting that, like, isn't that something that's really common with the rich? They're always obsessed with, like, how will they be remembered? Because in a way, it's about the continuation of the self beyond death. To be memorialized is in a way to obtain a degree of immortality. So my reading of the blackened blood red room, which is goth as fuck, is that it's a memento mori. It's the whole reason that the clock is there. You know, it's about remembering that you're going to die. It's about memorializing yourself. So it's not just sort of semi-religious. It's also massively bound up with ego and power.
Right, and it's the fascinating thing about that is that for a structure literally designed to avoid thinking about death and avoid confronting it, Prospero ends up building into it this whole chamber, specifically reminding everyone sort of you can't avoid it. It comes out, you know.
And you know, maybe that's a kind of really revealing thing, right? We try and push off the obscenity of death, right? We try and kind of hide away from it. But like the Gothic itself, the repressed will always return.
To kind of bring our discussion to a conclusion, what do you think Halloween signifies for us right now, when the world just seems to be so specially sick and on fire, and when the Prospero class, if we want to call it that, seems to have just unleashed all its most cynical, nihilistic impulses?
I mean, I think what does Halloween represent? We could talk about it in a number of ways. We could talk about it in this idea of kind of like the history of festivals, right, as mediated and contested disruptions of capitalist rhythms of work and exchange. We could talk about it in the history of as you said, the prophet or the fool in the court of the king, whose job it was to expose the hypocrisies and venalities of normal reality. And I think that's also something that I find interesting at the moment. We could talk about it in terms of catharsis and you know, the carnivalesque, the chance to kind of cast off and process the traumas of normality. But the big one that I think of is this idea of what do we mean by the norm? There's a lot of talk of like we have to get back to normal. And I think the Gothic and horror is good at kind of going, actually, normal was only ever an illusion. It's only ever a kind of maintained, collectively held practice. And normal is often an excuse for the disguise of the monstrous. It's a way of kind of, you know, tearing off the collective psychic band-aid, if you will. And I think this idea of understanding it as a chance of kind of like a joyful, cathartic, prophetic foolishness, I find really, really compelling. There's a really famous poem by Carl Sandburg, which I think is maybe one of my favorite pieces of poetry ever. It's very short. It's called Theme in Yellow. I spot the hills with yellow balls in autumn. I light the prairie cornfields, orange and tawny gold clusters, and I am called pumpkins. On the last of October, when dusk is fallen, children join hands and circle round me, singing ghost songs and love to the harvest moon. I am jack-o'-lantern with terrible teeth, and the children know I am fooling. Which I just love. I think of it as
love that, yeah.
Like a great expression of actually what is Halloween really for. And it's often turned into a very reductionist kind of political argument. You know, I guarantee that you can find libertarian institutions writing articles around this time of year for the past decade about how trick-or-treating is a great chance to inculcate your children into capitalism. I guarantee that they exist. But really, I really like Sandberg's kind of point. You know, it's this joyful catharsis. It's this confrontation with darkness, but done with kind of levity.
Mm-hmm.
The role of the fool, right there at the end of the poem, right? I am jack-o'-lantern with terrible teeth, and the children know I'm fooling. Not pretending,
mm-hmm.
but I'm fooling. And the fool and I think it's really interesting that you brought up the prophetic, because I think that directly connects to the role of the fool. And it, even in more contemporary circumstances, the clown. Clowns are both funny and scary, right? Halloween right. is fun and scary. And it's really important that it has both of those functions. Because that is when it's at its most powerful. I think Halloween is incredibly important, especially in the context of Christianity. Obviously there's the kind of pagan festival connections, but like in Christian theology it was about this confrontation with death. It comes before All Saints Eve, All Saints Day rather. So it's about trick-or-treating was also a way of going around to the houses of people who's had family who died. So yes, it is about death, but it's also about kind of seriously, as you say, making meaning out of something, confronting something that is often very terrifying, repressed, pushed away, and engaging with it in a way that is meaningful and even you know, subversively joyful.
Unlike Prospero, we can all look forward to confronting death and trauma and coming away stronger for it this year. Hopefully.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming on, John.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a real pleasure to talk about something so horrifyingly relevant to what we're all collectively living through.
John co-hosts the wonderful Horror Vanguard podcast, which you would be absolutely remiss not to go listen to right now if you enjoyed today's episode. You can follow him on Twitter at @TheLitCritGuy, and I would also suggest subscribing to John's YouTube channel, which is also called The Lit Crit Guy, where he makes video essays doing cultural criticism and political theory. Links to all those things in the show notes. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, social distance, wear a mask over your nose, thank you very much, and have a spooky and safe Halloween.
This has been Inside the Text. subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast app, and please leave a review. Since the host survives for the most part on the drip drop of steady external affirmation from others. Find us on Twitter at @inside_textpod. Theme music by Jed Cole. Other music in this episode is by Computer Music All Stars and Loyalty Freak Music. Links to the tracks in the show notes. Black Lives Matter. Keep fighting.